Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jose Vera, on behalf of the assignees in this case, the banks, and the original party, Billy Getchman Skiles. And I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay.
Getting started today, if you were to look at this case down below, it was service here was contended, as I understood it, always to have been substitute service. When I looked at the opposition on the appeal, however, service more or less became a hybrid possible substitute service or hybrid possible personal service. They kind of argued both points. And so I thought it was useful to look at the statements themselves, and I think that will help us out here a bit. The important thing here, I think, is that the first statement made by a declaration of service made by Mr. Wagner was that he actually served Ms. Getchman Skiles at the address of 41816. And the implication is personally served her, although the words personally served aren't in the declaration of service. The next declaration is filed, that declaration first is filed in December of 2014. The next declaration is filed in July 2015 and comes back and says, well, wait a minute, I didn't serve Miss Skiles. Instead, I served Kirk Banks, the farmhand. And I was confused about instructions and that I served Banks and not Skiles. And that seems pretty clear. And at least as if we want to look at the burden shifting analysis that may come up in questioning, you know, you have the presumptive first declaration of service that says, you know, you have valid service. And then you have a completely opposite statement by the process server saying, no, I didn't serve her. I served him. And I think that shifted the burden at that point in time, and it's obviously the evidence we moved on initially in the motion to vacate. What then comes next is the hybrid declaration, which says, well, let me be absolutely clear here. I didn't serve, I did serve Ms. Skiles at that address by handing documents to Mr. Banks, who was sitting about 3 feet from Ms. Skiles, and she was aware of my presence. And that's, you know, then as we argued this all the way up through the reviewing trial court level, it was kind of posited as substitute service. And again, here we are now today, and it's argued is possible both either service. And I think it's important to note that it fails at both counts. If we want to look at the Weichert factors, and I just picked that case from 1991. It comes in and says, well, all the words in at least the substitute service provision of RCW 42808-0 are elastic. And then it goes through a series of factors, and the cases that follow that also talk about a lot of these factors. Well, if you look through the cases, some of the common themes are completely absent here. There's no familial relationship between Mr. Banks and Ms. Getchman Skiles. Mr. Banks doesn't, there's no evidence he has a key. No one's alleged it. No one's claimed it. There's no evidence whatsoever he lives in the same trailer, under the same abode, under the same roof as Ms. Skiles. There's really no evidence of any connection between the two in terms of residing together. In fact, Ms. Skiles says in her declaration, he doesn't reside with me. I live alone. It's stated point blank in her declaration.
What's the significance of his caretaker role?
Well, the significance could be if he were truly a caretaker, because it's just a label put on. There's no evidence to suggest he was a caretaker for personally. The evidence is all that he was the caretaker of goats, because there's a goat. It's a 10-acre piece of property, and there's a goat ranch there. And he was taking care of the goats. Now, that may have more significance if the lawsuit was against the goats, but it's not. It's standing with Skiles. So the label itself isn't what governs here.
Does it have any difference? What the substance or merits of the litigation are in terms of analyzing whether service was accomplished?
Well, when you look at the Mullane standard here, now, you know, I do obviously recognize, and I think the court does, that you have to meet both the constitutional test as well as the statutory test. But the distinction matters, because if he were the caretaker of her personally and her personal needs, her business needs, or her life needs.
No, that's not the question I asked you. You said if the lawsuit were about the goats. And I don't understand why what the lawsuit's about plays any role in deciding whether service was completed.
I apologize then. Let me clarify. My comment meant if the goats were the defendants, then his status of the caretaker of the goats would have more relevance. The label itself would mean more. And I didn't mean to make a joke, but I was trying to make the point that it really does matter the relationship between the person served and the party. And when you look at the Weicker factors, in the cases that follow that, they really focus on the relationship. And here, there just wasn't a relationship whatsoever. But more to the point, we know from the evidence here in this case that the banks moved in 2013 or 2012, and they lived in a trailer in the back of the lot. That's in the record. We also know that Ms. Banks, or Ms. Wilson at the time, talked about drafting a lease for helping draft a lease for Mr. Wagner, who resided on a different piece of the property, between him and Ms. Skiles. And that lease was done in 2013. And the reason I bring that up is that, and that's in evidence as well, as part of the forest, it's one of the exhibits of the forest declaration. And the reason that's relevant here in material, because that shows that there's a relationship between these parties. It goes deep, and we'll talk about that in a moment in substitute service. But what it really says is that Wagner knows where Banks lives. He knows that he actually doesn't live in the trailer with Ms. Skiles. That in fact, they lives in the trailer in the back. And that's his own statement that collaborates that. That's his own lease that collaborates his knowledge and relationship with them predating service on Ms. Skiles. And I think that's a key point here, because that fact is not in any of the other cases that I have found anywhere. What happens when the person serving the defendant knows that the person resident therein doesn't live there, and they know it for a fact? And that, to me, seems outcome determinative all the way through. But putting that aside for the moment, and I want to go back and bootstrap that a little bit, we also have in the Wilson Declaration the statement that she often made dinner for them as well. And that, to me, comes back around, even if you want to come back and look at substitute service for a moment, because the hybrid third declaration from Mr. Wagner is strange. Because he never says, I went into her unit. I'm sorry, I'm out of time right now.
Thank you. Good rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Your Honors, my name is Roy Stegana. I'm sort of pinch hitting for Tom Hawes, who was unfortunately suffered some serious illnesses. I would submit that the issue is a very succinct, pure, and simple one, and it's this. Is there substantial evidence in the record that supports the trial court's decision to reinstate the default judgment? That's it.
Is it your position service was personal service or substituted service?
Actual. I would submit that. It's kind of interesting, you know, because if I handed it to her, if I'm the server and I handed it to her, that would be regular personal service. If she's sitting here and won't take it and I put it on the desk, or if she slams a door in my face, there's case law that says that what the server must do is to take action that's reasonably calculated to inform the defendant of the pendency of the lawsuit. That's what's required. Actual service. But the important thing, I think, is this. Washington courts have recognized that service itself, the fact of service, is far more important than the form, the return of service.
The thing that distinguishes the cases you've just described from this case is there's no evidence that I recall that she resisted or frustrated handing the documents directly to her. There isn't an explanation really for why they were handed instead to Mr. Banks.
Well, I think what I gleaned from the declarations was that he was there, she was sitting down, he was there, intervened. But I would, so you may be right.
Do you think Mr. Banks, from the declarations, is fairly characterized as having interfered with Mr. Wagner's ability to serve the original defendant?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would caution the court to remember, though, we have three declarations of service here, allegedly from Mr. Wagner. The second one is a forgery, and he has signed a declaration, the third one.
You said, did the trial court make a finding that it was a forgery?
No. I don't think it made any findings at all. But I think it's, I mean, no findings in the sense of, you know, findings of fact, conclusions of law.
So what is our standard review? Oftentimes when the record is completely documentary, it's de novo. In the Dolan case, Justice Chambers suggests when credibility is evaluated by the trial court, it's whether substantial evidence supports what the trial court decided, which is the right answer.
It's substantial evidence. I mean, that is the standard that we're facing here. Is the decision of the trial court supported by substantial evidence in the record? And I would submit that the most powerful, most positive, most important piece of evidence that is substantial, is beyond substantial, is conclusive, is the fact that after the service was made, an entry of appearance was made in response before the default judgment, before the default motion.
Can that really be the answer? We recognized for a long time what we used to call special notices of appearance to let people challenge service. In many of our service cases, someone has appeared and filed a motion under Rule 12 that service is inadequate and has used a lawyer to do that. So filing a notice of appearance can't vitiate a problem with service.
Well, I don't want to split hairs here, but I submit that there's a distinction that we have to be careful not to miss here, that service and return of service are two separate animals. The standard here, you know, we're not the only, you know, the standard about substantial evidence in the record is not the only one that we have to deal with. The appellant has a similar, has a standard, which is they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that service was improper. And so what we have here now, we have a decision of the trial court. We have a considerable amount of evidence in the record. I would submit strong evidence, good evidence on both types of service. But I think the real crux of the matter here is that service was effectuated factually, and the significance and, you know, the things that we're talking about on the return of service forms, Washington law is clear.
If there was any spin on this case that there was a default judgment, so then we use the CR60 standard of clear and convincing evidence, and that wasn't met, and therefore the trial court reversed the commissioner's decision?
You know, I don't know what the trial court's rationale was.
Well, none of us do. That's
there's no transcript. There's no order. There's no detailed opinion or anything of that nature. But you've got a situation here where, as the courts have said, you know, the appellate courts have said, failure to make a proper, accurate proof of service does not affect the fact of service. You know, we're talking about two separate things. And, you know, there's one other thing I want to make it very, very clear, that there was a second motion to vacate the default judgment filed after the appeal was filed. And in fact, the trial court says they declined to rule on that for a separate reason, which was that the original defendant had been deceased and the motion was filed without substituting the party. So the trial court, decided it could not hear, did not hear, and did not decide that motion. Much of what we have in the briefing by the appellant relates to that second motion to vacate. And the issues raised there for the first time, not properly, but raised, are competence and
That the trial court didn't rule on the second motion to vacate.
Say that again?
We're aware that the trial court did not rule on
the
second motion to vacate, and we don't generally review decisions people don't make.
Absolutely. My only point on that, Your Honors, is that much of the briefing by the appellant relates to those issues, the competency and a different return of service on the default motion. They're not before this court. The trial court could not have made a mistake with respect to those because it never made a decision.
Let me take you back to the third declaration and
sure.
closing phrase. Who was sitting in a chair a few feet beyond my reach, but who acknowledged my presence? In terms of lining up with the cases about personal service where someone won't take it or they shut the door on the person, how does that fact line up without any other explanation? Beyond my reach, does that mean physically I couldn't possibly have gotten it to her, or I was just standing, being casual about the way I was doing the service?
Your Honor, I wouldn't speculate on I would have to speculate to answer that question. Yeah, we
Well, what inference could the trial court draw from that?
Well, the trial court could the inference that I would suggest would be appropriate one in that situation is the defendant acknowledged him, she was there, He left it, the process server left it, you know, in her presence with another individual, and as it turns out, is a resident of that property. Now, we've heard the arguments about residency, but there's also substantial evidence in the record by declaration and by the declaration, I guess, of the private investigator who said that Mr. Banks, whose residency is in question there, had given that address as his residence for various purposes in connection with a criminal matter. I think there was a car title or something to that effect.
Does the record reflect whether the mobile home that Banks says he was living in has a separate street address?
I think the record's clear that there is no separate street address, that, in fact, whether he lives in a separate mobile home or not, he gave that street
address. My point is, then, that there's 10 acres there, but there's one street address for all of the structures on that 10 acres.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't really tell us what structure somebody's living in.
I agree with that. I mean, that's true. But on the other hand, you know, if the process server himself has said, this is my address, it simply points out the fact, Your Honor, that there's only one address for however size the parcel it is. So in any event, I would suggest that we should not be focusing so much on the return of service, but on the fact of service. Plus, irregularities in a return of service, if there are any, can be cured by amendment. And I don't think it's not really before the court, but an amended one was filed in opposition to the second motion to vacate, which was never decided upon. So if that motion, that second motion to vacate, were to be somehow reinstated.
You're kind of trying to have it both ways now, aren't you?
I don't think so, sir. No, not at all. Because if the...
if we're not going to consider anything the trial court didn't consider in connection with the defendant's motions, why should we consider things the trial court didn't consider that you filed?
I was just making the point, Your Honor, that maybe I overstated it, that irregularities in a return of service can be cured by amendment. Bad service can't
be cured by a document that was presented to the trial court at the time that it made its decision?
Let me think about that. No, it was given to the court when the trial court was deciding whether it could decide on the second motion to vacate. That's what I'm saying.
I understand the timing, but how could we say the trial court's decision is correct because of this document that the trial court never saw at the time it made its decision?
No. That's not what I meant to suggest at all, sir. My only point was that it can be amended. And if it's simply an irregularity, and in this case, the alleged irregularity is just lack of prejudice, subject to penalty of perjury. Thank you. I'm out of time. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
About 3 minutes?
Yes. To follow up on the court's line of questioning about a corrective declaration, the third declaration was the corrective declaration. And that's the problem. And so they did have a chance to correct. They saw the first error. They had a chance to focus on the fact of service. And Mr. Wagner offered up what he said was the correct declaration. The thing I wanted to focus on, to follow up on Your Honor's line of questioning on what's the last few words of that third declaration mean, what I want to focus on for a moment where it says, quote, who was sitting in a chair a few feet beyond my reach, but who acknowledged my presence. And what I found telling about that here is it doesn't say who acknowledged me handing up documents, i.e. like the Mullane standard would then could be triggered. He said, acknowledge my presence. This is someone who's lived on that property under a lease for years and has dinner with the Banks on a regular basis. So the mere fact he's there near Mr. Banks may be no more significant than it's time for dinner to go to the back part of the lot. And I just think, this is an ABC process server, someone you don't know, handing up documents saying, you've been served. In other words, the declaration would be a whole different story if it came up and said, I went up there, and even in this fractured structure, it said, Mr. Getchman-Styles, I'm not going to reach over to you, but you're being served with legal papers. I'm going to hand them to Mr. Banks. That may not still cut mustard, but that would be something worth talking about. Here, it doesn't even say that. It just says that she acknowledged the presence. And that is not enough evidence for this court to find that service has been effectuated. And to be clear, because of the trial level, there was no findings, in fact. And we did go back and try to get a record. And as has happened on many of my appeals from Stonewall Superior Court, there is no record of that hearing. And so we did try to present that to this court. I only make the point is that when you don't have a record, the standard of review is de novo. I think this court noted that in Northwick recently, that that is the standard of review, to look at this evidence and make the decisions. I do also point the court to the marriage of Log, 1994 decision, which basically states that a fact of notice does not confer jurisdiction in the court when service itself has been defective. And so the mere fact that someone may have filed, as the court, I think, correctly illustrated with this line of questioning, mere fact that someone at some point became aware of what was going on doesn't somehow cure defective service. And I think that's well within the law. I think that where this case stands out and why it may be published is because of Judge Talmadge's statement about drawing a bright line of when is too far, when is the words elasticity gone too far. And I think applying one address to define every possible abode for every structure on a 10-acre farm with multiple residents is a bridge too far. And I think this is a chance to draw that in and create lines for process servers. Thank you.
Thank you both. Thank you.